The Taima Mandala is a painting, Japanese painting, based, it tells the story of this sutra that I'm going to talk about today, the Sutra on the Visualization of the Buddha Amitayus. And just to give you a preview, the centre part of the picture is Sukhavati, with Amitabha in the middle, Avalokiteshvara and Mahasthamaprapta to his right, 34 bodhisattvas sitting around them, lotus ponds, people flying in the air, musical instruments flying through the air, palaces, pagodas, bridges, amazing. Down the left-hand side of the picture tells us left-hand side of the picture, little pictures, little square pictures telling the story of Queen Vaidehi, the story I'm just about to tell you. And on the right-hand side of the picture are the 16 meditations, which I'll say something about a bit later on, the 16 visualizations. Marvelous picture, brilliant book. So this talk is, as I say, on the Sutra on the Visualization of the Buddha Amitayus. And I've had a bit of trouble giving these talks. I can't quite get it right. The first talk I had loads of bits of paper everywhere and I couldn't quite get where I was going. The second talk I had it all on my computer, but I felt a bit note-bound. So I decided today not to have any notes and just look at the sutra and tell you bits and pieces about it. It probably won't be as polished as the other ones, but a little bit more spontaneous perhaps. So it begins, much as yesterday's began, the longer Sukhavati Viha Sutra. This is what I have heard. The Buddha was staying in Rajagriha on Vulture's Peak with the great Sangha of 1,250 monks. The difference is there were also 32,000 bodhisattvas there. How they all got onto the Vulture's Peak, I don't know. Who were led by Manjushri, the youthful prince of the Dharma. And then the scene switches to the city of Rajagriha, to a dungeon. At that time, there was a prince in Rajagriha called Ajatasatru. Under the influence of his evil friend, Devadatta, he captured his father, King Bimbisara, locked him in the seventh floor of the prison tower, and ordered his ministers to have no contact with him. Just tell you a bit of background to that. So there are a few characters here you need to know something about. Let's talk about Bimbisara first, King Bimbisara. King Bimbisara actually met the Buddha before the Buddha was the Buddha, when he was a wanderer. He was wandering around trying to find the truth, trying to find a way to the truth. And he wandered into the city of Rajagriha. And King Bimbisara was in his palace, happened to be looking out the window, and he saw the Buddha-to-be, let's call him Shakyamuni, walking, begging for food, and he was really struck by him. And he got a couple of his ministers, and he said, look, see that man down there? I want you to follow him and see where he goes. So they followed him around, and at the end of his arms round, the Buddha went out of the city, walked out of the city, up into the hills, and the two ministers followed him all the way to where he stopped. They came back, told Bimbisara where he was. Bimbisara got all saddled up and everything, went off out of the palace, out of the city, followed the Buddha, and found him, and had a conversation with him. Won't tell you anything about the conversation for now, but it was a very significant conversation, because at the end of it, the king said, look, when you found the truth, can you come back and tell me about it? So this was a promise that the Buddha made, and when he had become the Buddha, he made good that promise, and he walked a long, long way from where he was to Rajagriha just to explain about reality to King Bimbisara. So that's a bit of background to him. And the Buddha and the king were friends for the rest of their lives. The Buddha spoke quite freely to Bimbisara, and Bimbisara was a very devoted follower of the Buddha for the rest of his life. Devadatta, as I mentioned yesterday, Devadatta is cast in the Pali canon as evil. He didn't always used to be evil. He was a cousin of the Buddha, just as Ananda was a cousin of the Buddha. And he became one of the Buddha's disciples when the Buddha became enlightened, and he became a monk. And he was a very, very talented monk. He got into meditation very, very easily, very quickly, got into the jhanas, the form, the jhanas of the world of form, the formless jhanas, learned magical, how to, you know, disappear and come back and levitate and all that kind of thing. And according to the Pali Canon, after a while he began to think very highly of himself. And he got a bit annoyed at times when the Buddha was teaching, because everybody thought he was great, you know, oh, fantastic. And he thought, well, I could have done that. Anybody could do that. So he began to get a little bit above his station. And towards the end of the Buddha's life, the Devadatta, actually the Buddha was in Rajagriha at the time, and King Bimbisara was present along with lots of other people. The Buddha had probably just given a teaching, and Devadatta came up to him, bowed down to him, and said, look, you're getting old. Why don't I take over? I'll take over. I'll become the leader of the Sangha for you from now. And the Buddha said, no, in very, very strong terms. No way would I give you the leadership of the Sangha. I wouldn't even give it to Sariputra and Mahamoggallana, my greatest disciples, my chief and most wise disciples. No way would I give it to you. He said a little bit more there, but we won't go into that. And this made Devadatta very, very angry in his heart, and he went off determined to have his revenge. So what he did, he knew that Bimbisara was a very close friend of the Buddha, maybe not a close friend, but a friend of the Buddha and a very devoted follower of the Buddha. And he knew he had a son, Prince Ajatasattu. So he plotted. The son, Ajatasattu, was very, very impressed with Devadatta and his magical powers. Say again.
Impressionable.
He was very impressed. Anyway, that will do. And he spoke to Ajatasattu privately and said, look, we could take over here. I could become the leader of the Sangha, and you could kill your father and become the king of that kingdom. So why don't we do that? I'll have spiritual power, you'll have temporal power. So he agreed to that. So one night, Ajatasattu tried to creep into his father's bedchamber with a knife concealed in his robes. Just as he got to the door of the bedchamber, a guard stopped him, and he searched him, and he found the knife. He woke the king, and he said, look, this is your son, Ajatasattu, who's just coming here with this great big knife. So Bimbisara, shocked, said, what are you doing? What were you doing? And Ajatasattu confessed that he'd come to kill him. And Ajatasattu said, well, why would you want to kill me? Because I want to take over the kingdom. I want to become the king. So Bimbisara did something amazing. He said, you can have the kingdom. You don't need to kill me. I'll abdicate, you become the king. That was a big mistake of his. So anyway, that's what happened. Ajatasattu became the king, and that would have been the end of it had it not been for Devadatta. Meanwhile, Devadatta had been doing his best to kill the Buddha. Little did he know that it's not possible to kill a Buddha. The worst you can do to a Buddha is wound a Buddha, according to tradition. So he did his best. One day the Buddha was walking up and down, and I think it might have been the Vulture's Peak, at the bottom of the Vulture's Peak. Anyway, there's a great big mountain hill, and Devadatta pushed this massive great boulder over the top of this cliff, aiming it at the Buddha. It missed him, but a shard of the rock hit him and wounded him. On another occasion, Devadatta let loose a wild elephant at the Buddha. and it was running at the Buddha, and the Buddha suffused that elephant with metta, loving kindness, and it just stopped. So after, then he got some mercenaries, he hired some mercenaries to kill the Buddha, 16 of them. Each one of them went up to the Buddha to kill him. The Buddha converted them to the Dharma and they became his disciples. So in the end, tearing his hair out, as it were, Devadatta just gave up. And instead, he created his own Sangha. In doing that, he created a schism in the Sangha. So that's the background to the story. Shall we go on with the story from the Longa Sutra? So, Ajatasattra has imprisoned his father, Bimbisara, in the dungeon. And what he's now doing... Oh yes, I forgot to the... Devadatta was unable to kill the Buddha, and he was really at the end of his tether. So when Ajatasattra told him that he's now the king, and he said, "So did you kill your father?" And he said, "No, I didn't." He said, "Well, you need to kill your father." He was jealous of Bimbisara's devotion towards the Buddha. He just wanted him out of the way. So now Ajatasattra has imprisoned his father, and he's starving him to death. He's not giving him any food or drink. So the idea is that he dies in the dungeon. Bimbisara's concubine is what the text says, was Vaidehi, Queen Vaidehi. And the only person that Ajatasattu allowed to visit Bimbisara in the dungeon was Queen Vaidehi. So she went to see him every day. Little did Ajatasattu know that before each visit, she covered her whole body with flour and honey and ghee, and all her ornaments, her jewellery, she filled with grape juice. So she went in loaded with food, and the king licked her all over and drank. That always gets a laugh, I don't know why. And drank the grape juice, and this kept him going, just about kept him going. 3 weeks later, Ajatasattu was speaking to the dungeon keeper, and he said, "Is my father still alive?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, how can that happen?" So the dungeon keeper told on the queen. Now then, Ajatasattu was utterly furious. He called her a traitor. And he called her to him. And he pulled out his sword and he was going to kill her. Two of the king's main ministers, Chandra Prabha and Jivika, stood between the king and the queen. Ajatasattu, the now king, and Queen Vaidehi stood between them, and they grabbed their swords and they said, "You cannot do this. You cannot kill your mother. Seems okay for him to kill his father but not his mother for some reason in that particular society, but they said it's just beyond the pale to kill your mother. You cannot do that." And he dropped his sword and he asked them to forgive him. But he still threw Queen Vaidehi in another dungeon. Now, the king and the queen are in a terrible situation, impossible situation. Queen Vaidehi is utterly distraught. She's just spent the last so many weeks just doing her best to keep the king alive. She's obviously completely devoted to him, just trying to keep that king alive. Now she's unable to. So she's in the dungeon, imprisoned, and she knows her husband, the king, is going to die. What is she going to do? The imprisoned Vaidehi, emaciated with worry, turned to face Vulture's Peak, bowed to the Buddha and said, "The Blessed One, the Tathagata, used to send Ananda to comfort me. Now I am filled with anxiety and unease. As I am not able to gaze upon the face of the Blessed One, it is my heartfelt desire that the Venerable Modgalyayana and Ananda come to me here. So she asks that of the Buddha. The Buddha does that. He sends them there, but he comes too. Her tears fell like rain. She turned towards the far-off Buddha, bowed down in reverence, and lay there unmoving. On Vulture's Peak, the Blessed One understood Vaidehi's wish. He asked Maha Modgalyayana, as well as Ananda, to fly to her through the air. The Buddha himself vanished from Vulture's Peak and appeared in the royal palace. When Vaidehi raised her head, she saw the Blessed One, the Buddha Shakyamuni. His body was the colour of gold, and he was seated on a lotus flower made of 100 different kinds of precious substances. Modgalyayana stood to his left and Ananda to his right. Shakya, Brahma, the protectors of the world, and all the other gods surrounded him in the air, showering him with heavenly flowers. What an amazing image, isn't it? There they are in the air, golden. This lotus flower made of 100 jewels. When Vaidehi saw the Buddha, the Blessed One, she tore off her jewellery and threw herself to the ground. Through her tears she addressed the Buddha, "Blessed One, what evil have I done that resulted in me giving birth to such a wicked child? What kinds of causes and conditions have resulted in you, the Blessed One, being born into the same family as Devadatta?" This is interesting, isn't it? She's assuming that the reason that she's given birth to a Jatasattra and that Jatasattra is now doing this to her and his father is her karma. This could be an instance of a misunderstanding of the law of karma on Vaidehi's part, perhaps on the writer of the sutra's part, that everything that happened, the misunderstanding is that everything that happens to us is a result of our previous karma. But as we know, the Buddha didn't teach that. Not everything that happens to us is a result of our karma. There are other factors involved too. But it's as if she's assuming that the reason she's given birth to this son is because of something that she's done in the past, and the reason the Buddha has got Devadatta as a thorn in his side is because of something that he's done in the past. And it's interesting that the Buddha simply doesn't answer her question, just doesn't answer it. She then says, "Blessed One, it is my heartfelt desire," there it is again, "my heartfelt desire that you would reveal to me a place free of sorrow, free of the defilements. In my future lives, I do not wish to try to find happiness in this world of confusion and evil. This place of confusion and evil is filled with hell realms, hungry ghosts and animals. It is filled with misery. It's an impure world. We're living in an impure world, as I've said before, with all six realms, including the realms that I've just mentioned, filled with misery. It is my heartfelt desire that in the future I will not see any evil people or hear any evil words. I now prostrate myself to you, Blessed One. I repent and ask you to take pity on me. My only heartfelt desire is that the Buddha, who is like the sun, might teach me how to visualize a place where the effects of all actions have been purified." What I find interesting about this section here, her request to the Buddha, her heartfelt request, is that she's talking very much in terms of locations, in terms of places. This place, this impure world, is a place of evil and confusion and misery. I want to go to another place. Teach me how to visualize a place where the effects of all actions have been purified. Where is a place where the effects of all actions have been purified? The only place that can possibly happen is the mind. It's the mind, the heart, where the effects of all actions can be purified. There is no place. But as we've seen in Buddhism, mind and place are very, very much interconnected. The Buddha then sent forth a ray of golden light from between his eyebrows, which illuminated innumerable world systems in the 10 directions of space. The light then returned to the Buddha and gathered at the top of his head, which was transformed into a golden platform which resembled Mount Sumeru. All of the wondrous pure Buddha fields in the 10 directions of space appeared there. Some were made of the 7 kinds of precious substances, some of nothing but lotus flowers. Some resembled the heavens of the gods who enjoy the pleasures created by others, and some were like crystal mirrors in which all the other Buddha fields in the 10 directions of space appeared. In this way, Vaidehi was able to see an infinite number of Buddha fields in all their majesty. Vaidehi then said to the Buddha, "Blessed one, although all of these Buddha fields are pure and radiant, I wish to be born in Sukhavati, where the Buddha Amitabha dwells. My only heartfelt desire, blessed one, is that you would teach me how to contemplate that Buddha field and attain meditative concentration by doing so." This episode, I think, is a reflection of the episode 81 Buddhas ago with that Buddha Lokeshwara and his disciple Dharmakara, where Dharmakara said he wanted to see all the Buddha fields, show me all the Buddha fields, all the pure Buddha fields in the whole universe. And it took, what was it, 10 million years to show him. And then what did he do? Dharmakara concentrated all the best aspects of those Buddha fields into one, into Sukhavati. This seems to be a reflection of that episode. The Blessed One smiled. Rays of light of 5 different colours came from his mouth, and each shone on the head of King Bimbisara. Although the great king was imprisoned, he could see the Blessed One from afar in his mind's eye. Without hindrance, he bowed down to the Blessed One in reverence and attained the state of a non-returner in a spontaneous and natural way. 5 rays of light shining from the Buddha's mouth onto Bimbisara's head in his dungeon. And then the king bows down to him, and spontaneously and naturally he makes spiritual progress to the stage of a non-returner. So what's a non-returner? A non-returner has broken the first 5 of the 10 fetters which keep us bound to the world. They are self-view, rites and rituals as ends in themselves, doubt, sense desire, and hatred. Now it's interesting, isn't it? 5 rays of light. And I can't help thinking that that's connected with the breaking of the 5 fetters. 5 rays of light coming from the Buddha's mouth. And of course, the Buddha taught orally. So it's his teachings coming from his mouth onto Bimbisara's head. Now the head in Indian culture is not the seat of the brain. It's the top of the body. So the head represents the body. You know, when we do this in front of the shrine, body, speech, mind. Yeah. So the rays of light are coming down and suffusing the king's body with the Buddha's teachings. He's heard them before, but now he's accepting them fully into his body. He's being suffused by them. Do you remember a few days ago we were talking about the beings in Sukhavati, when they hear the sounds of the trees, they recollect the Buddha with their body. They recollect the Dharma with their body. They recollect the Sangha with their body. So he's imbibing it in his whole being. And therefore, the 5 rays of light break the first 5 fetters and he becomes a non-returner. And that's where we leave him. No doubt he died of starvation. No doubt. But we leave him in an extremely good state. He's lost everything. He's lost his kingdom. He's lost, tragically, his son. His son has turned against him. He's being slowly killed by his son. His son, who should love him and protect him. He's even lost his devoted concubine or wife, whatever you want to call her, Vaidehi. He can no longer see her. He's completely alone, trapped in a dungeon. But he's freer than he's ever been. Non-returners, when they die, they're reborn in something like a pure land. They're reborn in the pure abodes. And in the pure abodes, they gain enlightenment from there. So he's fine, actually. We don't have to worry about him. I'd just like to say a few words about Vaidehi, actually, because she's a wonderful heroine, one of the great characters of the Buddhist tradition, I think. And it's interesting that the Buddha speaks to her throughout. From now onwards, he speaks to her. Ananda's there, but he's speaking directly to her. And it's because of this, it's because of her request to the Buddha that the Buddha gives this teaching. So it's rather like the longer Sukhavivyuha Sutta, where it's because Ananda noticed the Buddha's golden appearance and mentioned it to him that the Buddha was able to give the whole teaching of the longer Sukhavivyuha Sutra. Similarly, here, it's Vaidehi who instigates that teaching. And the Buddha says of her, a bit later on, that she is an ordinary person with a weak and feeble mind. So it's contrasted to the first two sutras. The shorter sutra is given to Sariputra, who's a fully enlightened being. The second one to Ananda, who's well on his way to enlightenment. Both of them men, both of them monks, fully committed to the Dharma. Here he's speaking to a queen, obviously not an ordinary person in the social sense, but in the spiritual sense, very ordinary, nothing out of the ordinary about her at all, whose mind is weak and feeble, meaning, I think, that her spiritual capacities are weak and feeble. Obviously, she's not a weak and feeble person. That's very interesting, I think, and very important for the rest of the sutra, that she is an ordinary person. Remember that for the end here. I want to say something else about her, actually. She's obviously in a very, very difficult position, a very painful situation. Now, some people could say that she's asked the Buddha to tell her about Sukhavati as a form of escape, or as a form of escapism. Some non-religious people might point to this and say, well, this is so obviously religious, it's just a form of escapism. To those people, I would say, even if it were, what would be the problem? What else can she do but imagine herself in another place? What, she's done everything she can do. She has tried her best to save her king, but she's been unable to. So I would say she's not indulging in escapism. What is escapism? Escapism is distracting oneself from the situation you're actually in. Distracting yourself, dreaming about another kind of life somewhere else, and not actually dealing with the situation you're in, not dealing with the problems that you may have in this situation. That's what escapism is. And religious escapism is where you read the sutras, you talk to other people about them and so on, but you make no efforts to practice what's in them. So you're just escaping from your actual life by reading lovely stories like this. That's religious escapism. And I would say that Vaidehi is not practicing either of those, because she's done all she possibly could do to save the situation. And now she's in a situation where there's nothing that she can do. And I would just like to mention Bhante's great teaching on the difference between a difficulty and a problem, which I don't think we make enough of, actually. A difficulty is something difficult in your life, but it can be solved. It's like, let's say it's a problem that can be solved given enough intelligence and effort. If you make effort and use your intelligence, you'll be able to solve that difficulty. A problem, according to Banse's definition, is a problem. A problem cannot be solved on its own level, yet it has to be solved. Problem cannot be solved on its own level, yet it has to be solved. It has to be solved because it is unacceptable. The problem is so painful to be unacceptable to you. And we've all got difficulties and we've all got problems, and we don't distinguish between them enough, I think. So we often treat problems as if they were difficulties. We try to solve them. How many of you have had a problem, maybe personal or spiritual, for a number of years now? Put your hands up. And have you tried to solve it many, many times? Have you laid awake at night thinking how you might solve it, and it's not solved? So it's probably a problem then. Cannot be solved on its own level. Now, what does that mean? It cannot be solved on its own level, yet it has to be solved. It has to be solved because it's so painful. So how do you solve it? You solve it by becoming the kind of person whereby that is no longer a problem to you. In other words, you grow out of the problem. You grow into a kind of a person where that is no longer a problem. You gain insight, perhaps. And I would say that Vaidehi at first treated the problem she was in as a difficulty. She was working hard. She was going to see the king every day. She was covering herself with food. Every day she went to see the Buddha. No doubt she spoke to ministers and so on. She was trying very hard to solve that problem, but it would not be solved. So now she's in a dungeon. There's absolutely nothing that she can do. So now she realizes she's got a problem. She can do nothing except call on the Buddha. And the Buddha, arriving in her cell magically, the color of gold, with this marvelous lotus, with the gods showering him with offerings and so on, is the beginning of the solution to her problem. It's only the beginning, though. The Buddha said to her, "You do not know it yet, but the Buddha Amitabha is not far away." That's a very interesting thing to say, isn't it? He's, as we've heard, millions of Buddha fields in the west away. "But you do not know it yet, but the Buddha Amitabha is not far away." Spiritually speaking, not far away. "You should concentrate your awareness on that Buddha field and visualize it with great care. I will now reveal to you in comprehensive detail how you can purify the effects of your actions, and by doing so, so that in the future any ordinary person who wishes to purify the effects of their actions will be able to be reborn in the Western Buddha field of Sukhavati." Listen closely. Listen closely and reflect carefully on what I'm about to tell you. That's the Buddha speaking to Ananda and Vaidehi. That's not me speaking to you. "It is good, Vaidehi. It is excellent that you have asked me about this. Ananda," Ananda's there, "Ananda, you should bear in mind what I'm about to say and spread these words of the Buddha widely, sharing them with a great many living beings." So, as I say, for the rest of the sutra, the Buddha is talking directly to Vaidehi, but Ananda's there and he wants him to remember so that it can be shared later. "I will explain how to visualize Sukhavati for the benefit of Vaidehi and all living beings in the future." Now, the way that the third sutra, this the Guanjing, the visualization sutra, differs from the two Sukhavati Vyuha sutras in a number of ways. One of the ways it differs is it is a meditation. From now on, it's a visualization manual. It's a how to visualize Sukhavati and Amitabha text. The others just describe. This tells you exactly how to do it. It gives you very precise instructions. "Through the power of the Buddha, they," us, "will all be able to see this Buddha field as clearly as looking at their own face in a mirror. they will see the extraordinary, exquisite happiness that is to be found in that Buddha field. And because of the joy that will fill their hearts thereby, they will attain patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are arisen. So this is what's going to happen. Now, the patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are arisen are Shraddhapa's translation of Anutpatika Dharma Kshanti, which is, this is interesting, patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are arisen. That's the Kshanti. Now, some scholars are of the opinion that there's been a mistranslation here, that it's not actually Kshanti, that it's another word. They think that this idea has been taken from the Pali, so Kanti from the Pali is Sanskritized into Kshanti. And they think, some scholars think that it's been taken over into the Sanskrit wrongly, and that the root of the word is not Kshang, to bear, but come, to be willing, to like, yeah, to really like. So it can be accepted, the patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are unarisen, or it can be also translated as the liking of the fact, or the willing acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are arisen. What does it actually mean? Well, you know that everything arises in dependence upon conditions. But when you look more closely at that, we will see that no thing arises in dependence upon conditions. There is no particular thing that arises. In other words, everything is pure process. That's all I'm going to say about it here. But what the Buddha says here, that by visualizing Sukhavati, we will gain this insight, which is a very high insight. In later Mahayana tradition, it was connected with the eighth bhumi. The Bodhisattva works through the ten bhumis, and at the tenth bhumi they gain enlightenment. And this happens at the eighth bhumi. But that's the later tradition. In these texts, I don't think we've got to that later tradition yet. It simply means that you are now, once you've had that insight, you now cannot fall back from full and complete Buddhahood. So it's the Mahayana version of irreversibility. You become irreversible, not from arahantship, but from full Buddhahood. The Buddha then said, a bit more to say about this, isn't there? They will see the extraordinary, exquisite happiness that is to be found in that Buddha field, and because of the joy that will fill their hearts thereby, they will attain patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are arisen. So that insight comes from the exquisite happiness and joy that fills their heart as a result of visualizing the Pure Land. The Buddha then said to Vaidehi, "You are an ordinary person with a weak and feeble mind. You do not have the power of divine vision, so you cannot see things which are far away. All Buddhas, all Tathagatas have a range of skillful means at their disposal, which they can use to enable you to see." So the Buddha's going to enable her to see Sukhavati. He then gave very, very precise instructions on 16 visualizations. Obviously, we can't go through them. What I'm going to do for the rest of the talk is just look at three of them, maybe four. Going to look at the first 1.5 visualizations. Tell you why a half in a moment. I'll tell you why when we get there. And then we're going to skip to the visualization of Amitabha. And then we'll do one more. We'll look at one more, and that will probably do us. So, here's the first one. The Buddha said to Vaidehi, "You and all other living beings should concentrate your mind and gather your attention in one place. You should then focus your mind on the West. How should you focus your mind? all living beings, except those who are born blind or whose vision is impaired, should look at the setting sun. Gather your attention, sit upright, and gaze unwaveringly at the sun. Do not let your mind wander. Concentrate your mind without getting distracted, and look at the setting sun, which is like a drum suspended in the air. When you have looked at the sun in this way, you should be able to see it clearly, whether your eyes are open or closed. This is the first visualization where the mind is focused on the sun. This is the correct way to perform the visualization. Doing it any other way is incorrect. That's the first visualization. And it's marvellous, isn't it? It's so precise. And it's so much about samatha. It's so much about absorption. Just listen to the phrases. Concentrate your mind. Gather your attention in one place. Focus your mind. How should you focus your mind? Gather your attention. Sit upright. Gaze unwaveringly at the sun. Do not let your mind wander. This is not invitational language. In the mindfulness world, the language you use when you introduce meditation to be invitational. I invite you now to do this. This is not invitational. Vaidehi has implored the Buddha to help her, and he's doing that. Do this, do this, do this. Any other way is incorrect. This is the right way, that is not the right way. And it's so similar to the Kasana meditation, isn't it? The red sun in the west is just like the red disc of the Kasana meditation, and you should be able to see it with your eyes open or closed. Then follows the counterpart image. This meditation and the next one are what I call transitional meditations from this world to Sukhavati. It's interesting that the first couple of visualizations are not actually of Sukhavati. They're of things in this world. So you get to Sukhavati by concentrating on this world. It's not an escape from. You go through this world into Sukhavati. The Buddha then said to Ananda and Vaidehi, when you have completed the first visualization, you should focus your mind on water. Focus your mind and picture everything to the west as being covered by a great body of water. See the water as clear and pure. You should be able to picture it clearly with undivided attention. Now, in a sense, that's just water. So now what we've got is the sun and we've got water. But anybody who knows the longer Sukhavati Viyuha Sutra, this body of water is an illumined image. Because you may remember, if you were at the reading yesterday, towards the end of the sutra, Ananda asked to see Amitabha and Sukhavati. And what happens is he sees Amitabha rising up above all the Buddha fields in the whole universe, rising up above them, and the whole earth becomes, all the trees and the rocks and the walls and the houses and everything just become, as it were, flattened into water beneath him. So I think that when the Buddha tells her to visualize water, it's not just water, it's imbued with this image of Amitabha, who is like the sun above the water. So the sun above the water is more like Amitabha rising up above the pure Buddha fields and everything in this world becoming flooded with water. When you can see the water in your mind, imagine it freezing and turning to ice, brilliant and shining to its depth. Then picture the ice turning into lapis lazuli. And then it becomes really, really elaborate and complicated. The lapis lazuli ground is divided into different sections by a network of golden cords. The ground is divided neatly into sections, each one made of the seven kinds of precious substances. Each of these precious substances gives off light in 500 different colours, and this light can resemble flowers, the moon, or stars. This light remains suspended in the air and turns into a platform made of light. On this platform there are 10 million palaces made of 100 different kinds of precious substances. But it goes on. When you have successfully focused your mind in this way, make sure you visualize everything completely clearly, whether your eyes are open or closed. The image does not fade. Break off the practice only when it is time to eat. Keep the image constantly in your awareness. This is the correct way to perform the visualization. Doing it any other way is incorrect. Break off the practice only when it is time to eat. Now, that could either mean that this is for monks and nuns who are just on retreat all the time and they can just spend all their time visualizing and just stop when they have to eat. Or it could mean something else. There's a text, a Pali text, where Mahanama, the great lay follower of the Buddha, lay disciple of the Buddha, the Buddha teaches him the six anusatis. Anusati is recollection or remembrance. Recollection of the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha, those are the first three. And then generosity, ethics, and the gods. So he teaches them these six meditations, really. They're meditations. But then he says, you should be doing this all the time, when you're walking, sitting, standing, or lying. Whether you are at work or playing at home with your children, you should be doing this all the time. So this could mean that too. It could either mean that you just meditate all the time, or it could mean that you should be doing this in all of your waking time apart from eating. In other words, you're bringing Sukhavati and the world together in one. I don't think that the Buddha's saying you should be kind of split, that you're in the world but you're not in it at the same time. I think what he's saying that is that your imaginative recollection of Sukhavati should imbue your every waking hour, so that you're seeing the world through the imagination. Those who visualize the ground of Sukhavati will free themselves of the effects of previous unskillful actions that would have kept them in samsara for 8 billion aeons. And when they pass away, they will undoubtedly be born in that pure Buddha field. Have no doubt about this. So by visualizing Sukhavati, you end... When he's talking about the... when he's describing the ground, which is a bit more than the ground, as we've heard... I'll just read a bit more of it. Both sides of the platform are adorned with 10 billion flower banners and innumerable musical instruments. The light also emits 8 kinds of pure breezes, which make the musical instruments sound. They play songs of suffering, of emptiness, of impermanence, and of no self. This is the second visualization, where the mind is focused on water. So as well as deep concentration, now the Buddha has introduced vipassana, insight into the practice. And because of that, by visualizing the ground, you will definitely be born in Sukhavati because of the absorption and the insight. And in a way, you could just do the first two meditations then. Because just doing those first two meditations has everything. It has absorption of mind, and it has insight strong enough to allow you to be born in Sukhavati. So if you just want to be born in Sukhavati, you just need to do the first two. So why does the Buddha continue with all the other ones? We'll find out. So I'm going to skip many, many of them, and I'm going to move on to the visualization of the Buddha. Listen closely and reflect carefully on what I am about to tell you. I will give you a Dharma teaching on how to free yourself from suffering and from the defilements. You should bear in mind what I'm about to say and spread this teaching widely, sharing it with a great many living beings. As he spoke these words, the Buddha Amitāya appeared in the air above him, with the two great beings Avalokiteshvara and Mahāstāmaprapta on either side. They were blazing with light, so brilliant that it was impossible to see them properly. Even the radiance of gold from the Jambu River, multiplied 100,000 times, could not compare with it. So, by day he sees this vision, which is like, very similar to the vision that she had when the Buddha visited her in her dungeon, with the Buddha in the centre and Ānanda and Mahamodgalyayana on either side of her. This is like another one of those, only multiplied many, many times. The Buddha said to Vaidehi, those who wish to visualise this Buddha should gather their attention and focus their minds on a lotus flower made of seven kinds of precious substances growing from the earth. This is another transitional meditation. He goes into great detail about this lotus flower on which Amitāya sits, and it's a transition from the land to the Buddha. We're going to skip that. And then he says, when you have attained a vision of these things, you should then focus your mind on the Buddha. Why should you do this? The body of all the Buddhas, all the Tathagatas, is the totality of phenomena, and they enter into the focused minds of all things. The totality of phenomena, the Chinese is something like fajie, which is the Chinese equivalent of the Sanskrit Dharma Dhatu. The Dharma Dhatu, the sphere of reality. The body of all the Buddhas is the totality of phenomena, and they enter into the focused minds of all living things. What he seems to be saying is that reality is everywhere, even in the minds of ordinary living beings. Because what is reality? You could say reality is conditioned co-production. It's the rising and falling of all phenomena. So everything is real. Everything is real. Buddhas concentrate that reality in their form. And so by focusing your mind on the Buddha, you allow the reality to enter into your own mind. Therefore, when you focus your mind, again, focus your mind. Remember all those epithets used in the first visualization. Gather your attention in one place, etc., etc. When you focus your mind on the Buddha, your mind takes on the 32 major physical characteristics and the 80 minor physical characteristics of the Buddha. I'm not going to go into them now, because the Buddha then says it in non-technical terms. When your mind creates the Buddha, your mind becomes the Buddha. This is a very important phrase. When your mind creates the Buddha, your mind becomes the Buddha. So first of all, you create the Buddha in your mind. You imagine him in some way. But by doing that over and over, he's not saying it becomes the Buddha immediately. It might be many, many, many years later when your mind becomes the Buddha. But you've just started the process. When you create the Buddha in your mind, you start the process of yourself becoming that creation. You begin to become the Buddha. The ocean of all the perfectly awakened Buddhas arises from the focused mind. It was the Buddha's, before he was the Buddha, when he was a Bodhisattva, his focused mind, doing the mindfulness of breathing and so on, which allowed his mind to become the mind of the Buddha. And similarly, we focus our mind to become the Buddha. But here we're focusing our mind on the form of the Buddha. And it's interesting, if we go back a few sentences, it says, the body of all the Buddhas is the totality of phenomena. So it's the form, the kaya, the physical form of the Buddha. He goes on to say, when you focus your mind on the Buddha, you should begin by focusing on his image. So back to the Kasana meditations again, that threefold process. First you look at an image of the Buddha, then you close your eyes and see the Buddha in your mind. You create that Buddha image in your mind. Whether your eyes are open or closed, you should be able to see his image sitting atop the lotus like a jewel, the colour of gold from the Jambu River. When you can see the image of the Buddha sitting there, your mind's eye will open and you will be able to see him completely clearly. Your mind's eye will open. You could see that as the beginning of the third stage of the Kasana meditation, the counterpart image. Your mind's eye, your imagination has opened and you will be able to see him clearly. Not only that, you will also see the adornments of Sukhavati, which are made of the seven kinds of precious substances, the ground made of precious substances, and he goes through the whole of Sukhavati again. So what this seems to suggest is that by really seeing the Buddha, you therefore spontaneously see the whole of Sukhavati. Your mind's eye opens, your imagination completely opens. It's getting on for an hour now, everyone, so there's a few things I wanted to say, but I'm not going to be able to say them, so I'm just going to have to make a few decisions. Okay. Those who see these things in their mind in this way will see all of the Buddhas of the ten directions of space. And this is therefore known as the Samadhi of the Recollection of the Buddhas. This is really interesting. The Guanjing, as I've called it, the Visualization Sutra, is sometimes often put together with the two Sukhavati Viewer Sutras as a set. But it also belongs to a set of five or six Samadhi Sutras. And these Samadhi Sutras, scholars think that they may have come from Central Asia, where a bunch of people were practicing meditation together. And these sutras came out of that. And this sutra may have come from that area. We don't really know, but it could have done, because it's grouped together sometimes with those. And in the Samadhi Sutras, an important thing is this particular Samadhi called the Samadhi of the Recollection of the Buddhas, where you see all the Buddhas together, all the Buddhas in the whole universe. Those who perform this visualization will attain a vision of the bodies of all the Buddhas. By attaining a vision of the bodies of the Buddhas, they will perceive the mind of the Buddhas. By seeing those Buddhas, then they perceive their minds. The mind of the Buddhas is great compassion, an unconditioned compassion that embraces all living beings. Those who perform this visualization will be born in the presence of all the Buddhas when they die and attain patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are unarisen. It seems to me at this point that the sutra changes its direction. Up until now, Vaidehi has asked, I just want to be born in Sukhavati. That's all she's asked for. The Buddha teaches her how to do that. By the second meditation, he taught her how to do that. He continues. He continues to Amitabha. And he goes into great detail with Amitabha. And he says, when you do this, you're born in the presence of all the Buddhas. So it's as if the goal of the sutra is now switched from birth in Sukhavati to birth in the presence of all the Buddhas, where you will be born as a non-returning, an irreversible bodhisattva. You might think this is really hard work, but the Buddha then goes on to say, those who visualize the Buddha Amitāya should begin by becoming absorbed by one of his physical characteristics. They should begin by visualizing the tuft of white hair between his eyebrows clearly. That's how you begin. Those who visualize the tuft of the white hair between his eyebrows will naturally and spontaneously be able to see his 84,000 and other physical characteristics. Those who see the Buddha Amitayus will be able to see all of the innumerable Buddhas in the 10 directions of space. There's a very interesting cluster of experiences here. There's the seeing of all the Buddhas, being in the presence of all the Buddhas. There's being born in the presence of all the Buddhas. There's arising of the insight, the Anupatika Dharma Kshanti, the seeing that all things are unarisen. And there's irreversibility. All that happens in one cluster of experiences. So seeing all the Buddhas, not only do you see them, but they predict your future Buddhahood. I haven't got time to go into that here, but they predict your future Buddhahood. So all of these experiences are clustered together. The prediction of your future Buddhahood, the seeing of all the Buddhas, the being born in their presence, the arising of the insight, Anupatika Dharma Kshanti, and therefore irreversibility, all is one experience. And this is what the Buddha gives to Vaidehi. All she's asked for is to get the hell out of where she is. Please take me somewhere else. And he has given her this. The answer to her problem is this. She's still in the dungeon. It doesn't say at the end of the sutra what happens to her. As far as I know, she's in the dungeon for the rest of her life. Maybe she dies in the dungeon. But she is now an irreversible bodhisattva. You don't know that, actually, but towards the end of the sutra, that's what the Buddha says. I just want to finish. How should I finish, actually? I can't resist reading this bit to you a bit later on. When you have visualized these things, you should focus your mind and imagine yourself being born in Sukhavati, sitting cross-legged on a lotus flower. Imagine that lotus flower is closed. And then it opens. When the lotus flower opens, imagine 500 rays of coloured light shining forth from your body. Imagine your eyes opening so that you can see the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas filling the sky. Imagine hearing the sounds of the birds, the trees, and all the Buddhas, every sound proclaiming the wondrous Dharma in accordance with the 12 divisions of the sacred scriptures. When you come out of Samadhi, remember the things you have seen. Do not forget them. This is known as the vision of the Buddha Amitayus and of Sukhavati. At the end of that, at the end of the whole sutra, Vaidehi and her 500 ladies-in-waiting listened to what he was saying. This always makes me smile. 500 ladies-in-waiting. Where have they been all this time? Suddenly, they're in the dungeon with her. Must be a massive dungeon, mustn't it? They were immediately able to see Sukhavati with all of its many different features, and they attained a vision of the body of the Buddha and the two bodhisattvas. Vaidehi exclaimed, "I have never experienced anything like this before." Her mind became clear, and she attained great realization and patient acceptance of the fact that all phenomena are unarisen. Her 500 ladies in waiting developed mind set on unsurpassed perfect awakening, and a heartfelt desire to be born in that Buddha field arose in them. The Blessed One gave each of them a prediction that they would undoubtedly be born there, and that when they were, they would attain the samadhi of being in the presence of all the Buddhas. Innumerable gods also developed mind set on awakening. The Blessed One then returned to Vulture's Peak by walking through the air. Ananda told the great assembly gathered there what happened. Countless human beings, gods, nagas and yakshas rejoiced when they heard what the Buddha had said. They venerated the Buddha and left. This is the sutra on the visualization of the Buddha Amitayus as spoken by the Buddha Shakyamuni.